equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Now, this is Carl Ettner, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays, and my theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. I've got a blog on the same subject. It's called Relocalizing Vermont. It's one of the mini blogs at the Vermont Commons website. That's vtcommons.org. There's a new post I put on up over the weekend on why being an astronaut in the space shuttle is safer than driving. You believe that? Well, if you report the statistics the way people do when they say that flying a commercial airline is safer than driving, then the space shuttle is even safer than that. Check it out, vtcommons.org/blog. And audio for my Monday broadcasts is posted at equaltimeradio.com. That's equaltimeradio.com. I usually try to get it up by the end of the day after, by the end of Tuesday. This week it might go into Wednesday because today and tomorrow I'm here in Burlington broadcasting remotely from the Council of State Governments meeting here. And if you're listening to the Mark Johnson broadcast live from here this morning, don't worry, I don't plan on covering much of the same ground, at least. I'm doing general reporting and gathering of background information on the conference. I just wanted to avoid missing several hours here to travel to Waterbury and back, not to mention all the fossil fuel that would burn. But our great show is going to be talking to doctors about health care in a time of energy scarcity and economic restructuring. And our first guest is Marvin Malik. He's a physician in Barrie, at Barrie Internal Medicine. And his unhappiness with the way patients are treated has led him to try to reform the system. We'll talk about the health care debate in Washington and how health policy affects people's ability to adapt to a changing economy. Our second guest will be from Massachusetts, Jill Stein. She's a spokesperson for the Massachusetts Coalition for Healthy Communities. She's also a medical doctor. She will speak at Goddard College in Plainfield on Friday about how energy scarcity is likely to affect health care. So in the second half of this show, we'll get a sneak preview of what she will be saying there. And incidentally, both doctors care so much about health care policy that they've run for statewide office on a health care reform platform. Marvin Malik ran for Vermont Lieutenant Governor on the Progressive Party ticket, and Jill Stein ran for Governor of Massachusetts in 2002 and Secretary of the Commonwealth in 2006, both times on the Green and Rainbow ticket. I want to thank Goddard College's radio station, WGDR, for lending me some of the equipment to do this remote broadcast, and Mark Johnson for lending me the rest. I'll be rebroadcasting parts of it on my WGDR show on Thursday morning, 8:30 to 10 o'clock. Before we jump into our discussion with Marvin Malik, I wanted to do just a little bit of reporting from the conference. I went to the Energy Committee breakfast, or at least part of it, this morning, and heard the various state legislators and presumably representatives from the executive branch, because they're represented here at the conference as well. They were looking at the climate change bill that's currently going through Congress, the Waxman-Markey bill that passed the House and is now over in the Senate being worked on. They were asking, what does it mean for states? And Vermont State Senator Ginny Lyons, who was on this show about 2 months ago, talking about how Vermont leads the nation in many parts of energy policy, she raised a question about what happens to the carbon credits issued under the regional cap and trade convention that Vermont already participates in. It's called REGGI, R-G-G-I, Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. This convention provides a stream of revenue to the states right now. Vermont uses the money to fund energy efficiency. Will that revenue continue when there's a federal cap and trade? How much will that supplant what the states are already doing? Well, the Council of State Government staff who were presenting this morning, they were uncertain about exactly how it would work in the bill that passed the House, and of course, no one knows what will come out of the Senate and the conference committee, but it sounded like there's a provision to maintain the revenue stream. So that's the sort of thing that people are talking about here at the meeting of the Council of State Governments, just trying to watch what is going on in Washington, figure out how that affects what they're doing in their various state houses, and plan accordingly, and also planning just things on their own independent of Washington. Speaking of state houses, if you were listening this morning to the keynote speaker on Mark Johnson's show, David Hale, he was talking about how the Arizona legislature is planning to sell their state house, or at least discussing it, and then buying it back from private investors over the years. And he sounded pretty enthusiastic about that. He was talking to people on Wall Street to try to arrange for more legislatures to sell their state houses and buy them back from people on Wall Street. So keep your eyes on that story. Jim Douglas commenting on it said he didn't think that was in the cards here in Vermont, but we'll see. Look at my blog at vtcommons.org. Oh, in the next day or so, I'll comment more on David Hale's talk. So let's get to our featured guest for the first half of today's show, Marvin Malik, a physician at Barry Internal Medicine. He's worked his entire career in internal medicine. That's primary care and hospital medicine, and he's gotten advanced training in health policy. He's gotten active in health policy issue because he was so outraged at the way his patients were treated by today's medical system. They can't afford the care they need. They get financial stress on the system. People who get sick actually need to use their insurance can't. The insurance companies waste his time, his staff's time with paperwork, and so on. So he works as a medical doctor, taking care of patients every day he's at work. Has a lot of paperwork from the insurance and sees some dysfunction there. Marvin Malik, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Carl.
So,
I want to make a few corrections on what you said. I currently work at Central Vermont Hospital. It certainly is internal medicine, and not at Barry at this point, also, at least most of the time. And the other thing, I think the statement that I'm unhappy with patients' treatment is not the best way I would say it. I think that the healthcare system in the U.S., the way it's structured, has unusually drastic implications for people who actually get sick, who aren't really wealthy. If you're not really wealthy and you get sick, there's a good chance that you're going to end up facing a lot of financial liabilities that many, many people just cannot afford. And that is unique to the United States. And so
as long as you don't get sick, then the system works fine for you.
Absolutely. If you're healthy, generally things are just dandy.
And most people are healthy most of the time.
And it seems to me that many of the policymakers in the country are acting as if that's the norm. Hmm. But in fact, at some point in most everyone's lives, they're going to face an illness, and it's not until then that people suddenly find out what happened. And I have to say that many times patients who I've maybe known for a long time or treated for a long time, when someone in their family actually gets sick, they'll come to me and often say something like, how did you, and by you they mean all of us who are in the system, you know, doctors, hospital administrators, all of us, how did we allow this to be this way? And it's that feeling that it's that question that I get periodically from people who have never been sick before and now are. It's that question that gnawed at me and that has spurred me to become politically active. Because unfortunately, I think that the solutions lie in the political sector, and I wish they didn't, because the political sector is messy and it's hard to work in and it's hard to accomplish anything for many reasons. I'm sure you know them because, you know, you're involved in energy issues more, but it's hard to create change when it needs to happen. And certainly in both the areas of healthcare and energy, big changes are needed. And unfortunately, you do have to fight in the political sector, because if we don't, nothing will change.
Well, I look forward in the second half of this show to talking with you about the connections between the energy questions that you mentioned and the healthcare questions with our second guest, Jill Stein. But for now, Marvin Malik, could you just give us an overview of your take on what's happening with the national discussion of healthcare?
Well, unfortunately, Obama has made a decision to greatly limit the change that I think the voters asked for. He didn't run on some sort of status quo platform like Dwight Eisenhower, you know, many other politicians have done over the years, or Jim Douglas. You vote for Jim Douglas, you know nothing is going to change. Just sort of subsist the way we are, even if it's not working out. But with Obama, people thought they were voting for change. And the kind of change that Obama's talking about in healthcare is not significant enough. he is willing to say that everybody should have health insurance, and he's going to probably move us in the direction where more people will have health insurance. But his unwillingness to really explore the system and take on all the dysfunction, or at least much of it, and instead confining himself to relatively modest structural change, what that will mean is that if his proposals actually succeed in insuring more people, we will pay through the teeth. And, you know, Kent Conrad, the senator from North Dakota, has made the statement that, you know, that people in the U.S. Senate, where he is, deal with many, many issues, you know, ranging from energy to foreign policy to, you know, border issues. I mean, they've got numerous issues. But it's health care that's the 800-pound gorilla, because that's the one that's bankrupting many individuals and putting major financial stresses on our government and on businesses and everyone affected by the healthcare system, which is everybody. And so he's taken off the table looking at the drug companies, taken off the table looking at the pharmacy benefit managers who are sucking profit out of the system, taken off the table the whole insurance industry, which is the biggest one of all. And what he's doing is this piecemeal approach will be very expensive. And when you're going to insure people and creating a system that has a lot of expense, somebody pays for it, and either it's going to be high deductibles and copays that we're all going to pay, or the government pays, which means ultimately taxes either go up or we put ourselves further into debt. Those are the options, and they're not. It's not a pretty picture. It's really sad.
Howard Dean is arguing right now that he's kind of cagey. He's sort of implying, and sometimes it seems he comes right out and says it, that single payer is really the best option. But he's saying, in terms of what's politically tenable, it's not tenable right now. And so Obama's plan to put a public option out there that would be available for everyone and allow people to keep their own insurance but migrate to the public option if they think that's a better deal is a way to sneakily put in the basis for covering people under the public option, under a single payer, if they choose to do so. What are your comments on that?
Well, I don't think you can call it a single payer, because it's going to be one of many payers that would presumably be competing in all parts of the country. As long as you have a multi-payer system, you have inherent inefficiency. We cannot reduce the administrative costs in any offices. And there are other major areas of cost savings that a single-payer system allows. They range from planning to having superior negotiation, you know, when they're trying to get pharmaceuticals at lower prices or wheelchairs at lower prices. The VA is the only powerful negotiator we have in the U.S. that really has gone some distance with the drug companies and really pushed down prices. And that needs to happen. There's no benefit to us by paying these extortionary profits to drug companies. That's something that a single payer would be in a unique position to take on. There's all this trend talking about variations in care, and a single payer system would do much, much better at actually addressing that issue. This is very stylish now in Washington, that some parts of the country care is much more expensive than others. And, you know, they're going to try to work on that, but with a chaotic multi-payer system, they'll be very limited in what they can do. And, of course, the biggest one of all is administrative savings. So for many, many reasons, a single-payer system is far more efficient. All the other developed countries, with minor exceptions, use some version of single-payer. The only bigger exception is Switzerland, and they come in second place in most expensive healthcare systems. And
so Bernie Sanders, it's
really not working out, and Howard Dean is really doing us a disservice by saying that what Obama's proposing is actually going to effectively rein in costs in healthcare. It won't.
So Vermont's junior senator Bernie Sanders, he is trying to take the stigma in Washington out of the term single payer by pointing to Medicare and calling it a single payer system and saying, how many of you want to dismantle Medicare? But you disagree with him. You think he's off base on that?
That for senior citizens, Medicare is somewhat of a single payer. It started out as a single payer system. Then under Ronald Reagan, they started subcontracting Medicare to private insurance companies. And that actually raised the cost to the taxpayers because you're adding back in all the administrative costs and all the dysfunction that private health insurance companies create. They systematically picked off the healthiest people to insure, enticing them with somewhat better benefits, and the taxpayers paid for the profits those companies were making. And it's been a bad deal for taxpayers, and it's really unfortunate that that happened. So, yeah, it started out as a single-payer system. It's been relatively efficient in terms of administrative costs. It's still very expensive because people over 65 have the highest health costs by far compared to people younger than that. So it wasn't going to be cheap, but yeah, it's some version of single payer to the extent that that's left for after what, you know, Reagan and subsequent presidents have done to it.
Yeah, that sounds like quite a few caveats on that.
I just want to make a comment on the politics. Howard Dean and others can say that that's all that's politically possible in Washington. I think they're drastically wrong. I think Obama had a historic opportunity because there's two things that a president can do. Yeah, we want some good policy to be enacted, and that's important. But Obama has the ability as a great speaker to really explain to people all the ways that our system is dysfunctional and how a single-payer system can provide everyone really good care without all the waste that we have now. Because, and I'll tell you, whatever Obama proposed, it didn't matter. He could have proposed any of 5,000 things, and it was guaranteed that the insurance industry and the Republican Party were going to say, big government, government takeover. It didn't matter what he was going to propose. So why not propose something that can actually work instead of giving in? So here's what he should have proposed. He should have had private meetings with all the senators and representatives, asked them if they could bring themselves to vote for single payer. He'd find out they could that it couldn't pass. And then he should say, first of all, I want you to vote in people who will support this. And secondly, we are going to allow at least 5 states, probably more, willing states to enact single payer as models for the country. And we will take out all the crap, frankly, that stands in the way of states doing this on their own. We'll eliminate all of those obstacles, bureaucratic obstacles. And that's how he could have done it. And another thing, he could have said, and by the way, we are going to create a single-payer comprehensive system for every child in the country, period. And I think he could have sold the children. He would have had opposition, but it would have been a hard thing to say that every child in the country should not have health insurance just the way Medicare is for senior citizens. I think those would have brought us much closer. The political cost would have been a whole lot lower than what he's having to go through with his grossly inadequate plan. It's really sad.
Well, now that we are where we are, we do have Bernie Sanders talking about pushing an amendment to allow what you were talking about, 5 states to experiment a lot with different ways of providing health care, and he would like to see Vermont be one of those and use a single-payer system. What do you think the prospects are in, you know, the way the bill seems to be heading, if that's included, for a single state to reap a lot of the advantages of a single-payer system?
Well, first of all, I think there's also a bill for a national single-payer, and for the reason that we all know that it doesn't have a chance of passing, that's hopeless. But I think this bill you're talking about, the state-by-state bill, I think it deserves a lot of support, and I think it has more hope. And I think if Obama starts having trouble, he'll probably get reelected, and I think before his 8 years go by, I think that health costs are going to be so high, and this whole thing will be so out of control. Now they're talking about tax increases that would put us on a level with Sweden and the highest tax countries, yet we get nothing for it here in the U.S. You know, at least in Sweden, they get child care and they get, you know, unemployment benefits are fabulous, you know, cradle-to-grave health care. We pay all this and we get nothing. And I don't think it's going to work out for him. I think he's going to be in real trouble politically, and I think the country will be in trouble fiscally. And I think that state-by-state thing is a better option for him. He's not going to be able... There's just too much power of the insurance industry in Washington to pass it nationally. But I think to clear out some obstacles... You know, he could even throw in saying that 5 or 10 states can really get the barriers out of the way to do what the Republicans want. You know, let them really have their Darwinian healthcare system. And let the federal government give each state the same amount of money per capita. Some of us will try single payer. Other states can do the Republican, you know, utopian dream. And let's see which one works better. I'll tell you what I think will work better, but let's play it out.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Carl Ettinger. We're talking with Marvin Malik. He's a physician at Central Vermont Hospital about healthcare policy. And I want to turn the question to things more related to my usual theme of energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. One of the things that I see a great need for in this economy is a lot of entrepreneurship, people willing to take on new tasks in the economy that have been neglected by the corporate economy and really build a stronger local economy. I also expect that there are a lot of people who are afraid to leave their corporate jobs before they're fired because they don't know where their health care, their health insurance will come from if they do that. And Marvin Malik, as a physician, I'm wondering how much of that you see in your practice.
So I mentioned earlier that there are people whose health is adversely affected, who are personally going bankrupt, a lot of mortgage foreclosures due to health care. So there are people can't get emergency care in many parts of the country. Primary care is a crisis across the country. These are big dysfunctions. So you're now talking about the effects on business. And business is also hamstrung by the healthcare system. I just want to put in perspective that it's what we're about to talk about is a huge problem, but maybe it ranks sixth or seventh on the list of dysfunctions that this healthcare crappy system is causing. Okay, so small businesses are systematically discriminated against in our healthcare system. They can't get a good deal. It's even worse for very small businesses. And if you're an individual person trying to buy health insurance in the U.S., good luck. You'll get unbelievably bad coverage with pre-existing condition clauses. Same thing for very small businesses. And moderately small businesses with 25 or fewer employees get a really bad deal. So what that means is that if there's someone who has a great idea to start an energy-related venture, and let's say they're working at IBM or some big company where they have good health insurance, that person is likely that the venture is going to start small. So uniquely in the United States, no other developed country, that person, there's a good chance that he or she will not leave their job. They'll stay there in some boring or unproductive job that they're frustrated with. They want to do something more, and they can't because they cannot jeopardize their family's health care.
Are you aware of people who are in that situation?
Oh, you better believe it. That's something you see all the time. I have a patient whose wife, who's in a two-person business, is a business himself, and his wife actually went to nursing school, didn't want to, but figured that in healthcare she'd be able to get health insurance. She actually wanted to work with him. He needed a bookkeeper and someone to do that work, and she's actually trained in it. She wanted to do that. They looked at the situation and they realized one of us has to have a job that provides health insurance. There's no way we can afford it as a two-person business. She ended up becoming a nurse. Frankly, doesn't really like it. Wants to be with her husband. She's very kind of person, really, they really love spending time together. They just as soon do that. So there she is, you know, in nursing instead of them being able to work together. So very, very common that you're dependent on a spouse. I just have the fellow who's actually about to do some work on my house just had his own business and was depending on a spouse for health insurance, and the spouse has become sick, needs health insurance, had to leave the job that she had, so now he's forced to become an employee in a fairly, you know, boring job that does provide health insurance. This kind of stuff goes on all the time.
Yeah,
very dysfunctional.
I know people like that as well.
And it occurs in no other developed country. This is unique to the United States. Only in the U.S. do we systematically discriminate against small businesses and new business ventures. It's terrible.
How about comments made by the keynote speaker here in Burlington at the Council of State Governments Conference this morning, who's broadcast on Mark Johnson's show, David Hale? He was asked about rationing. He was saying the U.S. is the only industrialized country that doesn't ration health care. And somebody asked him, well, what about people who can't afford it? He says, anybody who needs health care can go to the emergency room and get what they need there. What are your comments on that?
All I can tell you is that in the emergency room, they're not going to provide treatment for high blood pressure. They're not going to provide treatment for diabetes. They're not going to get to know you over time. They're not going to work on preventive care. It's not going to do anything to prevent breast cancer and make sure that that's taken care of. They're not going to do pap smears to prevent cervical cancer. They're not going to be accessible if the problem is relatively more minor. It's that is a completely self-centered, thoughtless thing to say. You know, there's a fellow named who does the 2020 show on ABC, Stossel, John Stossel, and he made that statement once. It turns out that fellow has severe stuttering disorder, and he went through extensive treatment with a skilled speech and language therapist. And he was saying the exact same argument that David Hale said, that, you know, there's really no problem for people without health insurance. He correctly said that anybody can go to an ER, an emergency room, they can't turn you away. And I just wonder how John Stossel, whether he'd be on ABC right now, if he had no health insurance and would have had to paid his way through every speech and language therapy session that he took over many years.
So if he turned up at the emergency room and say, help, I'm stuttering, can you help me?
I think that it wouldn't have gotten very far. And it's really discouraging, you know, that people are so thoughtless and insensitive that they can make that argument. You know, the Institute of Medicine has estimated that in the U.S. we have about 22,000 deaths that are brought on by lack of health insurance coverage. Some of them are direct, people in the middle of cancer treatment, and you see that on TV fairly frequently, who just abort their treatment, they can't afford anymore, lost their health insurance, and they're out. And you get these terrible situations in families where someone might have wanted to be treated, but they know they're going to put huge financial burdens on their families, so they, you know, maybe the treatment's only 25% or 40% likely to work. You know, do I go on with treatment and bankrupt my family when I might die anyway? It's just horrendous, the kinds of things that go on.
And can't get chemotherapy at an emergency room either, I take it.
Yeah, I don't think it's happening. And it's just so thoughtless for people to make that statement. And, you know, the other irony in saying that is it turns out that there's tons of research showing that ongoing primary care, patients who have a strong relationship with a nurse practitioner or a primary care physician, the cost of their care actually are far lower than for people who don't have that relationship. And unfortunately, given what they're doing to primary care practitioners, making it so hard to do that job, you know, one of the poorest paying jobs compared to alternatives that, you know, most of us in medicine have, and all these people without health insurance who couldn't afford, you know, primary care even, it's very dysfunctional. They're undermining that, and we're ending up with a system that leads to more expensive care.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Equal Time. This is Carl Ettmeyer, and I am broadcasting from the Council of State Governments Conference up here in Burlington, talking about health care with physicians. And our next guest is Jill Stein. She's going to be talking on healthy people, healthy planet, healthy democracy, and how to get there from here this Friday at Goddard College in the Haybarn Theater in Plainfield at 7:15. Jill, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carl. Good to be here.
Good to have you on. And Jill, you have done a lot. You are the co-founder of the Massachusetts Coalition for Healthy Communities. You've co-authored Environmental Threats to Healthy Aging and In Harm's Way, Toxic Threats to Child Development. You've been a staff physician at Harvard Community Health Plan and a former instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School, and so on and so forth. You've done a lot, and you're now looking at the effect of peak oil and energy scarcity on health care. What do you see in your crystal ball?
A lot. Dr. Malik was saying in the earlier part of the program, you know, we have a healthcare system which is really in disarray and unraveling. And I first want to just say I completely agree with him, you know, as to what the problem is and where we need to go, that health care for profits rather than for people is not serving anyone, not our families, not us as individuals, not our businesses, not our economy, the whole nine yards. This is just not working, really, except for the pharmaceuticals and the insurance companies and for the politicians that have cozy relationships with them. So I want to really underscore that reforming health care really through a single-payer system, which is really the only way to really address the problem and really fix it. We know that from all kinds of experience, but I really strongly agree with him that that's the fix we need. And in the meantime, our health care system and our health is having a lot of problems. So one of them from the outset, you know, is that there are real system problems here. And Marvin Malik did such a good job of talking about that, I won't spend more time on it. But as you mentioned, Carl, there are some other elephants in the room here that are really impacting both health care and our health. And, you know, I want to name not only energy and the rising cost of energy, and particularly fossil fuels and oil derivatives around the corner, which we saw briefly until the economy really kicked back. But we will see again if and when the economy goes back into gear. So that's a real problem now, but it will become much worse. Even the Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Energy, its statistical branch, issued a statement really 2 years ago that the supply of oil had essentially peaked, and we know in 2005, and we know that when that happens, price inflation is around the corner because the oil gets harder to extract, but also because there's growing demand, you know, coming online from developing countries around the world. So there's going to be enormous pressures on the cost of health care, which is already unaffordable. Health care is highly energy dependent. Not only that we need to move supplies around, patients and providers need to get to and from facilities, food, et cetera, but supplies, all sorts of bread and butter supplies that we are currently dependent on, from IV bags to catheters to gloves to syringes to disposables, et cetera. So much of what we now do in modern medicine, unfortunately, depends on fossil fuel derivatives. So this is a real good time for us to be moving away and getting to more sustainable forms of health care. But real briefly, I want to make the point that it's not only energy that's an elephant in the room here. There are many other elephants in the room that, fortunately, there are converging solutions that kind of address them in one fell swoop. So I'll come to that in a minute, but first, just to make the point, you not only have, you know, the issue of fossil fuel depletion, you also have climate change, which is a health problem and a growing health problem, such that the prestigious sorry, I'm getting a buzz here. I'm going to shut this off. The prestigious medical journal, The Lancet, issued a statement, actually a rather substantial report in the last month or two, establishing really that climate change, in their view, is the number one public health problem for the foreseeable future, impacting potentially billions of people. And they actually put a number on the current number of deaths taking place globally, which is on the order of 300,000 approximately per year, taking place on account of heat waves, drought, storms, floods, as well as the other issues of the disappearance of ice sheets, which is another matter unto itself. But you know, the issue of rising sea level is already of concern, you know, certainly to island communities and to low-lying coastal, but the potential is there for really dramatic rises in sea level. And we keep finding that the predictions to date really don't begin to, you know, to adequately characterize the problem. And we hear this continually from the climate experts, you know, including the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that, you know, the data continues to astound and defy the models that currently exist. And it keeps, you know, getting, you know, more worrisome. But the silver lining here is that what fixes the climate crisis also fixes the energy crisis. And of particular relevance to the topic here today about health and healthcare is that if we do the right thing that we have to do for energy and climate and for our economy to survive oil shock and climate shock, the good news is that that's also really, really good for our health. And I'll just give you one quick anecdote that sort of describes this. In Cuba, in the late 1970s, their oil pipeline went down overnight. They lost their fossil fuel supply, which was imported through the graces of the Soviet Union, essentially. So overnight, they had to get off of oil. And fortunately, they had some blueprints at their universities. They were interested in organic agriculture. They had plans and models, and they basically implemented them and went to human and animal-powered labor, organic, non-fossil fuel dependent for fertilizers, for machines, and for pesticides. And very quickly, Cuba sort of became the leader in sustainable agriculture. Also, of necessity, they kind of took out their bicycles, and now they could walk down the street without encountering a traffic jam and air pollution. So people had to use what we call now active transportation to get where they're going. And the bottom line is, nobody died, nobody starved, everybody lost weight, obesity rates went down 50%, activity rates went up 50%, and the bottom line was that they accomplished a public health miracle that we never have accomplished, and we couldn't dream of accomplishing sort of through our current, you know, sort of a private profit driven healthcare system. And what happened was that their mortality rates, their death rates from diabetes plummeted by 50%, their death rates from cardiovascular disease went down 35%, from stroke 20%, and overall mortality went down 18%. Now,
well, that sounds like a much different picture of the future than we hear from a lot of people who are talking about peak oil and energy scarcity in the future. If you're just tuning in, we've been hearing from Jill Stein. She's a medical doctor, a co-founder of the Massachusetts Coalition for Healthy Communities. She'll be talking on this subject at greater length on Friday evening at Goddard College in Plainfield in the Haybarn Theater, starting at 7:15 p.m. The title of her talk is Healthy Planet, Healthy People, Healthy Planet, Healthy Democracy, and How to Get There from Here. We also have on the line Marvin Malik, another medical doctor who's worked with health policy quite a lot. And Marvin Malik, I'd like to hear your comments on the Cuba scenario and the chances of that, something like that, playing out here in the United States.
Well, it's hard to imagine exactly that circumstance. Cuba is very unique in many ways. Is an extraordinarily efficient healthcare system despite very limited resources, and they've been basically since the late 1980s, they've done all they can to make their country more efficient. And by using energy more efficiently, they have saved themselves a lot of money and prevented a greater decline in their economy than would otherwise have occurred with the withdrawal of support from the Soviet Union. Energy has been a big area where they accomplished that. And the benefit to the public health that Jill has pointed out is a real plus. It wasn't why it happened. I don't know what it would take in the U.S. to get people to do better. I have to say, though, that I really feel that this event, I hate to pound on Obama, but the economy was really in bad shape when he took office, and I really personally feel that what really should have gone on for a stimulus package should have been a drastic change in energy consumption in the U.S. I think every city should have been encouraged to develop public transit systems that work. Light rail, tremendous savings in energy, and it's, as Jill pointed out, the savings, the health threats of climate change, in addition, in other words, you get benefits to health as well as benefits to the energy and climate global warming situation. The same thing occurs with public transit. There are many, many more deaths in Los Angeles on the way to work than there are in New York City where they have public transit. And that's including the actual minimal number of assaults and muggings that might occur. The number of people dying on the roads is much greater. You can imagine the effect on global warming when everyone in Los Angeles, 23 million people in Southern California, are forced to drive cars to get to work. It's incredibly inefficient.
Point. Jill Stein, Cuba is, of course, a communist dictatorship, and we so far are not. What are the chances of us following Cuba's path with our democratic system?
You know, I don't think, the intent here is not to follow Cuba's path. You know, Cuba had really a devastating impact on their economy. Their economy basically contracted by 50%. You know, our economy contracts by 1 or 2 or 3%, and there's incredible pain, so we don't want to wish a contraction on our economy. Nonetheless, I think Marvin's points are really important, that we expect our government and our policy to run on behalf of people, not on behalf of lobbyists, and not on behalf of the status quo that's doing very good if we just keep things going the way they're going. And we keep hearing the excuse that, the political climate won't allow this. Well, to that we say, our political climate, well, then we need to change that political climate. And if our leaders aren't going to change their minds, then we need to change our leaders. These aren't sort of discretionary questions here. You know, should we have a healthcare system that saves money and works for everybody? Should we have a planet that actually, will exist for the next generation or two? You know, that the climate will actually be survivable and consistent with a food supply and with oceans which can be fished and so on. These are not discretionary questions. The science is pretty clear here, about what needs to be done and the way forward, yet somehow we manage not to have the political will. And, you run around in the circles of advocacy for so many years, so you get the idea of how this game is played, and then you realize the rules of the game really need to change here. This isn't about needing to encounter the crisis of Cuba in order to enact reasonable transportation policy. You know, it's not a rocket science about what we need to do, as Marvin articulated. We spent, over $3 trillion basically on a Wall Street bailout, and we're not exactly sure how much it was.
These are not discretionary questions. I think that's a very good, solid way to put it. We have one more guest that we're going to squeeze in before the end of the hour. Marvin Malik, I want to thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Keep up the great work, Jill.
Likewise, Marvin.
Take care.
Hope we cross paths out there.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The person who is bringing Jill Stein to Vermont is Suzanne Richman, and she's a director of the Health Arts and Sciences program at Goddard College. Suzanne, welcome to the show.
Welcome, Jill, almost to Vermont. We're very, very excited that you'll be joining us in the Hay Barn at Goddard on Friday night.
And thank you. Can't wait.
Warmly welcome.
And tell us in just 1 minute what Health Arts and Sciences is about.
The Health Arts and Sciences Bridging Nature, Culture, and Healing program is one of several programs at Goddard College. And we bring students together to study an engaging mix of integrative health studies and holistic sciences and the broader social and ecological perspective that you and Marvin have been talking about. The important piece for us in health arts is that we do need to create healthier communities as this long-term alternative. And if we create healthier communities, we'll have people with their local food systems intact, and we'll have healthcare settings that are stress-relieving for those hard-working physicians like you and Marvin. And we'll have social support and social ties for people in recovery from difficulties in their lives. So we're excited about creating the basic whole healthy community spaces that will keep people from getting sick. So we're looking at the preventive side that you and Marvin alluded to as being so important in our future.
Very good. Well, that sounds like a program that we could devote quite a bit of time to on a future show. Suzanne Richman, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
And Jill Stein, thanks so much for calling in from Massachusetts. Look forward to seeing you at Goddard College on Friday.
I'll look for you there, Carl. Thanks so much.
Okay. If you want to hear more from Jill Stein and bring your concerns to the table, come to her presentation. It's at Goddard College in Plainfield, Friday night starting at 7:15. It's the Hay Barn Theater. Don't have a pencil to write that stuff down just now? The information will soon be at the Equal Time Radio website. I'll put it up right after the broadcast. It's www.equaltimeradio.com. Healthy People, Healthy Planet, Healthy Democracy, and How to Get There from Here is the title of Jill Stein's talk. I'm Carl Ettner. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday. Jeff Mapes is the author of Pedaling Revolution, about advocates for bicycling and bicyclists. He'll be the guest along with Vermont cycle advocates. www.equaltimeradio.com is podcast. Artie Levine produced the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
A violent windstorm on Sunday knocked out our electricity, and our two-day-old chicks could have died. It made me realize how dependent even our local food systems are on a continuous flow of energy from outside the region. Chicks need warmth. Lots of it. My books tell me to give them a temperature of 90 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 32 degrees Celsius, during their first week of life. In the natural course of things, they get this warmth under the wings of their mother, or another hen that adopts them. These days, with machine brooders keeping eggs warm and robotically turning them several times a day, the newly hatched chicks are warmed by heat lamps in most backyard chickening operations. I picked up a half dozen chicks at the outdoor farmer's market on Saturday. They were a day old. These tiny peeping birds were destined to be my source of eggs, starting in the fall. I was told to be there right at 9 a.m. when the market opened, so I could transport them home to warmth right away. They were waiting for me at the farm stand, packed in a small box maybe half the size of a shoebox. I took them home and put them in a much bigger cardboard box, lined with newspaper, giving them water, feed, and heat from a 150-watt heat lamp. Then Sunday afternoon, a violent windstorm knocked the power out at our house, sometime between 4 and 5 p.m. I don't know exactly what time, as I didn't have any lights on. When I discovered the outage, I went right down to the outbuilding the chicks were in. It was cold. One of the two windows had blown open, and the glass had blown right out of another one. It was probably 50 degrees Fahrenheit in there, 10 degrees Celsius, and windy. Not so windy down in the chicks' cardboard box, but they were huddled together in a corner for warmth. I ripped up some newspaper and crumbled it to make a little nest for them in the small box I'd picked them up in, moved them over to that box, and brought them into the warm house. I wrapped a sheet doubled over several times around the box for extra warmth. I figured the power would be back on in a couple hours, and that short time in their little nest box wouldn't hurt them. By the time it got dark, the power was still out. I brought up their larger cardboard home from the outbuilding, plus their feed dish and waterer. My wife and I lit candles, donned small headlamps, and puzzled over how to keep the chicks warm while giving them access to feed and water. I finally rigged up a candle lantern for them. The lantern burns warmly at about the height of the chicks' heads. Now, I know what you're thinking. A candle lantern in a cardboard box, lined with newspaper, surrounded by chicks who don't know anything about fire safety. That's a bad recipe. Well, I suppose it could be. I figured I just needed to make sure the lantern wouldn't tip over. I hung it from a lanyard, putting its full weight on the bottom of the box so the chicks wouldn't knock it around too easily. If they did hit up against it, the lanyard would keep it upright. That worked for a while. The chicks were warm from their little nest box, and they scampered about their old home, eating and drinking to their heart's content. By the time we were ready to go to bed, though, the chicks were huddled up against the lantern for warmth. There was room for 5 chicks around the lantern, and there were 6 chicks. We needed a different solution. I finally decided to put them back in their tiny nest box for the night. They'd been eating and drinking, and in the dark they'd fall asleep immediately, so I hoped they wouldn't miss the food and water much. I lined the nest with some wool from a great Pyrenees dog we used to have, put them back in the little box, and wrapped it in the sheet again, leaving just a little air hole at the top. By morning, the lights were on again. I took their home with a heat lamp back to the outbuilding and let them loose in it. They stood dazed for 30 seconds or so, and then started running around, pecking at their food and drinking. They'd made it through their night without electricity. I had accepted that my little foray into backyard chickening was highly dependent on external energy. The farmer and I both drove to the farmer's market, where I bought the chicks. The feed came from far away. I was just starting on the road towards egg self-sufficiency. But chickens and feed can be stockpiled. You don't need energy every day for them to work. It hadn't occurred to me how dependent they were on electricity every hour of the day, during their first few weeks of life. Even for those of us who think a lot about energy, it can be surprising how dependent we are. Some people around here may have had electric brooders full of eggs. I wonder how they got through the 8-hour outage. I hope they had a backup generator. I'm Carl Ettinger, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.